Hey, this is Tim Dillon. Did you know we do the show live every Tuesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern? You can watch live exclusively at GasDigitalNetwork.com. Gas Digital members not only get the live stream, but also the video version of the show. Live chat, archived episodes, plus brand new episodes 5 days before they go on iTunes, Google Play, or anywhere else. We've also got a bunch of other great shows on the network, like The Joster Show, Legion of Skanks, High Society Radio, and many more. That's GasDigitalNetwork.com. When you check out, use the promo code HELL and save $1 on the monthly membership. Plus, you get a 14-day free trial just to see if you like it. That's just $6 a month. That's GasDigitalNetwork.com, promo code HELL when you check out. And even if you can't subscribe, you can help us out by subscribing for free on iTunes and leaving us a positive review and a 5-star rating. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in hell.
Dylan is going to hell.
We're
going to
really take a hard, critical look at the people that society's decided to hate, the billionaires, the dictators, the CEOs.
On Gas Digital Network.
We know that there are bad things in the world, there are bad people, and thank God for them.
Won't you join him?
What's good without evil? This is Tim Dillon, everybody. Thank you guys for tuning in to Tim Dillon's Going to Hell. We are here with our co-host Ray Kump.
Hello.
We are also here with our returning guest, one of our favorites, the great Russ Baker, author of the book Family of Secrets.
If phenomenal.
If you have not read it, get it. Also the founder of whowhatwhy.org, one of our favorite places for online investigative reporting. And he's here today because if you have not read this, and a lot of people are, and I see it being shared, it's being shared on Twitter and Facebook, and everybody that has read it is commenting, which is always a good sign. People have been affected by it. More than one person tweeted at me and messaged me and said, you got to do a podcast on this. There's so much here. People wrote things like, this is real journalism. And they've done a really great job here. I think it's about a 6,500-word piece.
Substantial.
A substantial effort here, basically in detailing some of the relationship between the Trump administration, and Donald Trump himself, with figures in the Russian underworld, politicians, and of course, looking at the angle, the FBI, and why perhaps the FBI is reticent to disclose everything they know.
That's surprising, because the FBI,
always found the FBI just such a straightforward and forthcoming group of people. Amazing that they would. But Russ, thank you for coming in.
Sure, glad to be here.
And so let me ask you, after the election, it was so divisive. I kind of fell into the belief system that the Russian narrative was kind of a way for people to explain the election results. You know, the media had gotten everything wrong. The polls were wrong. I think it was a traumatic event for a lot of people.
Sure.
So I kind of dismissed a lot of this as this is just part of the grieving process.
And we've also on the show discussed often our point of view that it seems like the intelligence apparatus and the deep state was trying to push this narrative of a Russian. It seemed to us like they were trying to push another Russian Cold War. Instigate and escalate with Russia.
You know, but one thing I have, when I read the article here, when I read the piece, I realized that this was a bit, as most things are, this was a bit more complicated. Did you have any of those feelings after the election, or did you think immediately there's probably something here?
Oh, no, absolutely. I was very wary of efforts to stir up that traditional rivalry. Over the years at Who, What, Why, we've reported how Russia has played an interesting and even somewhat constructive role in being maybe the only power in the world that can question this sort of monolithic war machine that historically the United States has been. And so, yes, I would agree with your assessment of that. And I think, therefore, just like you and Ray, we come at this honestly, approaching this from an open mind, not embracing this narrative particularly, but starting to see some things that made us say, we better take a closer look.
Right. And one of the things, so the article, and again, people should read the article. I read it about five times because there's so much there. But what's interesting to me, what strikes me, and I know a little bit about New York City real estate, and so what is interesting is, you have Donald Trump as a real estate mogul. He's got a big building on Fifth Avenue, and a lot of the old money buildings in New York City, Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, they're co-ops, and they have boards, and those boards want to see all of your financial documents before you move into that building. So if you are somebody who's made your money in a less than reputable way, if you are considered new money, if you're a Russian oligarch, if you're a gangster, you end up moving into some of these newer condos. And many of those people actually ended up moving into Trump Tower. A lot of these gangsters and a lot of these people that later on were arrested for all kinds of nefarious activities. And this story really focuses on a few particular people, but one of them is a guy named Felix Sater. And this guy is somebody who, he worked closely with Donald Trump. And this is somebody who now Donald Trump is kind of very much like George H.W. Bush kind of forgot where he was during the Kennedy assassination. Trump has now been quoted saying things like, well, if he was in a room with this guy, I'd have trouble identifying him. But tell us a little bit about this particular individual, because he seems to be very important in kind of linking all of these things together.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, it's kind of funny because you can say something like, I'd have trouble identifying him in a room. That doesn't actually mean that you wouldn't know exactly who he was, but
right. You
would get in trouble for identifying
right,
him. So
right. Technically
that could
yeah.
be true.
Interesting.
Yeah. I noticed that about a lot of statements. Like Trump says things like, he'd say things like, I have no business in Russia, which doesn't preclude that he had business in Russia,
right.
That he has business in other former Soviet republics, that
he was financed
his partners,
by the Russian mob.
His partners have business in Russia.
Right.
You know, I mean, whatever. There are many, many permutations of this kind of thing. But anyway, getting to the heart of this.
Yeah.
So this building, Trump Tower, when it was built, as we report in our article on Who, What, Why, they had all this amazing bunch of people who were quite interesting. And we started looking at the floors below. Trump had this triplex, the top three floors, and right below it are the choicest floors. And I don't want to say that everybody, because it wasn't, I assume, everybody, but an awful lot of the people on those floors at the top are these very interesting characters, like a woman who was the lady friend of the boss of the mobbed up concrete union. And of course, the concrete union is what put up Trump Tower.
Right.
And so his lady friend, who somehow happens to have all this money, not clear where it's from.
Right.
She buys all these apartments, and then she wants to, you know, combine them all. And then she wants to put in a swimming pool
yes.
in her own apartment.
And I think Trump helped get her a loan. Right?
Yeah. I mean, just the craziest stuff. But anyway, he knew her. He knew the concrete boss really well. But when he dealt with the concrete boss, he went through the mob lawyer, Roy Cohn, I guess,
right.
for denial. Ability.
Yeah.
There was another guy in there who ended up being arrested, I think, in Trump Tower for ordering a murder. That guy, Donald Trump, personally sat with him at a conference table, and as the man counted out $200,000 in cash
right.
to get the deal going. So, I
right.
mean, it's not like he didn't know these people or,
right.
you know, I mean, if...
Is some of that unavoidable, though? You know, when you put up a glossy building in the middle of New York City, that some of these characters are going to be attracted? Or was there something special about the culture of Trump?
I think there was. I mean,
yeah.
I think it was the bling factor that
yeah.
the kind of people who like to wear a lot of gold chain and stuff like to be associated with a very gold building
right.
and a very golden man with
yes.
golden hair to
right.
be
right.
optimistic
right.
about his hair. You know, and so they saw this as this marvelous brand, just as maybe another generation saw Gucci, you
right.
know, or Pucci or Fiorucci.
Right.
Saw Trump as the name to be associated with. But, you know, the thing is that Trump would have to be naive not to know the extent to which real estate is used for money laundering. And he would be naive not to know that people coming from a country where nobody had any money and suddenly they're billionaires, that you do have to wonder where they get the money to buy these apartments.
Right. So Felix Sater is a guy that grows up. He was born, I believe, in the Ukraine or Russia.
He was born in Russia.
And
his
grew
father,
up in,
his father's Ukrainian.
Right.
They emigrated when he was young, came to the United States.
Grows up in, I think, either Brighton Beach or Sheepshead Bay, one of those areas, maybe, I forget, Brooklyn. He grows up, And he goes to jail. I think he stabs a guy in the face with a margarita glass in 1991.
In jail?
No, before he gets to jail. That's what gets him
to
jail.
They had stopped serving margaritas in jail.
They'd actually relaxed the margarita service. But he becomes involved in a bunch of different schemes and eventually becomes an informant for the feds.
Correct. The background on that is that there was, they call it the Russian mob, and I guess we can use that term, but basically it's not Russian, it's mobsters from the former Soviet Union, so it's from all the different constituent parts of the Soviet Union, and actually even other Eastern European countries, but there always was some sort of organized crime, even under the communist system. The jails were full of these people, although they also were tolerated in certain ways because people who were in official positions who needed to move their ill-gotten money themselves out might need these people protection and internal feuds and what have you. They also provided a lot of goods. They worked actually very closely with the Soviets. There was an electronics store here in New York that's also connected to the story. I don't know if that's even in the piece because we had to cut
remember
so
that,
much.
But yeah.
But one of these people we mentioned, they had an electronics store by the UN, and the Soviet diplomats were always in and out of that. And the mob was very helpful in supplying the Soviet Union with all kinds of contraband stuff that it needed. So these people there, some of them began emigrating while there still was a Soviet Union. And then when the Soviet Union ended, there was, you know, the floodgates opened and all these people left. And by the way, even before that, the Soviet Union, under pressure to release so-called dissidents or people of other belief systems, opened their jails up and let all these mobsters pour out. And many of them came, among other places, to the United States. So they were already here.
And that was in the 80s?
That was going back to the 70s, actually, with the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. But in any case, these people began looking for opportunities. And, you know, it's not like they didn't go to Yale. You know, they're not
right.
going to get hired immediately by Goldman Sachs, maybe later. But they were looking for opportunities, and you tend to fall into those sorts of circles. And some of them began working with the La Cosa Nostra, the Italian mob.
Yeah.
And so they began working with them, but they started looking for opportunities. And as the Soviet Union came apart, more and more highly educated people left. And a lot of these people had degrees in computer programming, computer science, mathematics, all sorts of – they were very skilled people, financial whizzes and so forth.
Right.
And here they are in the United States. What are they going to do? They don't even speak the language properly. And they found these illicit trades.
Yeah.
And a lot of them started – moving into these, you kind of like out of Wolf of Wall Street, these,
sure.
you know, these kind of these shops where they were boiler rooms, you know, where they were working all kinds of schemes
pump and dump stock schemes.
Well, that's what Felix Sater did.
Right.
And even though he was born here and even though I've never met him, but I assume he speaks accentless English, he ended up working in one of these places. We're going to have another article coming out soon with some more on some of that. Some other interesting people in the Trump administration who come out of the same shops.
Interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, and so he got into this thing, and there were all these mobsters involved, and it was, as you say, a pump and dump, basically calling little old ladies and anybody they could target who they thought were not financially sophisticated and selling them on these wonderful opportunities, you know, these penny stocks, whatever. And of course, they knew the stuff was worthless.
Right.
It was illegal what they were doing, and they took people for an awful lot of money. The FBI was investigating these things, as they do financial crimes. And right at the same time, they became aware of the Russian mob, belatedly, I must say. The FBI often becomes aware of things kind of belatedly.
Right. You know? Like 30 years, Hoover said it didn't exist.
You know, you hit them on the head with a shoe for a few years, and eventually they pay attention. But Hoover said there was no organized crime at all. So you can imagine it would be hard to go from that to Russian organized crime. Anyway, they start looking at this stuff. And they start asking around, and they learn that there's this guy. And I hope I'm not stepping on your intro here, but they start looking. They start looking. There's a guy. You know, it's organized.
Yeah.
Who's it organized by? And then allegedly, and of course we always use the word allegedly with all this, it is run by a guy. Some people called him the Fat Man. And some people called him the Brainy Don. But he was a guy by the name of Semyon Mogilevich.
Yes.
And he was.
I watched a BBC did an interview with. Him.
Yeah, it's great to watch him because he's right from Central Casting.
He's out of Central Casting. And what's fascinating about the Russian mafia is that that when I was, you know, and you go into this a bit in the article, that it's different than other mafias in that there's such a level of state backing that it's almost like it's a mafia state because you have a lot of state actors involved with organized crime. And I guess it would almost be like, you know, the Italian mafia in the 60s where they had the power to influence the political system in a way that they don't anymore. But so this guy, this Simeon, is somebody that supposedly has some level of relationship with Putin.
That's where we're going. And I just want to be clear here, if anyone listening starts wondering, like, what does this have to do with Trump? It's got everything to do with Trump. And Trump's always just a step away from all this. So, correct. Exactly right. What we're looking at is it is said by the experts that this Russian mob was very close and is very close with Vladimir Putin, and that Semyon Mogilevich and Putin are very close.
Now, was the Russian mob used by the KGB back in the day?
Like, it was used, correct, Ray. And so so they have had a symbiotic relationship all the way through, and very important today. And so in fact, the whole Russian government and the economy, a lot of the people who were in KGB, GRU, all these different intelligence agencies, when they lost their jobs, they were looking for work. They sometimes ended up in organized crime.
Right.
Have other buddies who then got rehired.
It's a revolving door.
Yeah.
Have it with Goldman Sachs and our government. It's the same type of thing.
Yeah. That's right. And so there really is no, you know, it's totally permeable. So anyway, you have all these people and they all know each other and they're all kind of working together. And then you got these oligarchs and now there's all these guys with billions of dollars out of nowhere. And they're either enemies of or friends of Putin. And, you know, who knows where he's got all his money stashed. And so, of course, there's all this need to wash all this money, get it out of the country for safekeeping. And, of course, real estate is maybe the best place to park it, as also are, by the way, these various kinds of companies where you can appear to lose a lot of money. It doesn't even matter because you're really just trying to wash these sort of obscene sums through the company. And the losses can paper over where the money came from and where it ended up. So what you're looking at is Semyon Mogilevich. FBI becomes extremely interested in him. He's called the boss of bosses of this important
mob. And it's said that he can affect the world economy.
How can he do that?
So that's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you specifically, but we see a lot of references to that where they're talking about the FBI and the Department of Justice are talking about their capability. I think what they mean is that they had these people who were doing computerized trading. They were attempting, you know, they were doing hacking. You're able to get into the computers and once you've got people in the supply chain, you know, in all of these companies at various different levels, you could do almost anything you want. It really kind of is almost like out of a James Bond movie, you know, this unaccountable octopus-like entity. And by the way, they had, I understand, or have thousands and thousands of soldiers. I mean, just an enormous, just an army of them.
Okay.
So this far, I mean, besides the state cooperation with them, does this far outweigh the scope of the height of the American mafia, the Italian mafia?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it really does. And they were just much better also at getting into so-called legitimate business. And by the way, banks and developing relationships with big banks. I think there's still a lot more to come out about. It turned out they were involved with the Bank of New York. You may remember that big scandal and the collapse of the Bank of New York. Mm-hmm. Other banks, the Safra Bank and so on and so forth. Many, many banks. And now we hear about new names of banks we hadn't heard of before.
Well, what's really interesting about this article is it underscores, I mean, there's certainly a lot of intrigue involving Trump and everything like that, but it also underscores this idea that at the apex of society, you have gangsters, bankers, politicians, they're all kind of sitting at the same table.
I like to say that, I mean, we all know the term the underworld. I like to use the term overworld to describe these so-called legitimate players because who themselves have sort of, let's call them criminal tendencies or a lack of ethics or morality and a certain ruthlessness. And it's very, very hard to separate the underworld from the overworld, except that the overworld are friends with the people who make the laws, ergo they are not susceptible to them.
Right. So the FBI becomes interested in Mogilevich. And is this when they turn Felix Sater?
Right. So what we understand is that the the FBI was so desperately interested in bringing him down. And once they started looking at this company that Sater and his friends were involved with, they could see signs that this was orchestrated at a higher level. And somehow, I guess, they determined that Mogilevich had his hand in that, that this was one of his operations.
Now, was there a event that's spurned the FBI into action with this? Like, did the Russian mob, was it really behind some kind of high profile?
How did they? Well, yeah, it was a company called White Rock, also later called State Street, and I don't remember the specifics of how they first got onto it, but these kinds of things happened pretty organically.
So that's what kind of led them onto the case of Mogilevich.
It's what led them onto the case of Felix Sater. In other words, they came onto him, they came onto this whole scheme. I think they realized that there was a mob connection to the scheme because of the people who were involved and how they operated. And at some point, what we understand is that Felix Sater made a deal with them, and he said, I know a lot, and I could be a big help to you, what can you do for me?
Which is a ballsy move if you're talking about informing on guys like Mogilevich. And I mean, from what we understand about the Russian mafia is that they are brutal and ruthless,
right,
and extremely deadly. So to cooperate with the feds for as long as he did, that's got to be, I mean, that's something where you're like, this is interesting.
It's very interesting.
Did they have a lot on him, or what was the reason he did this?
Why did he turn?
Yeah, why did
Because he was personally liable for something like $40 million.
Okay, yeah. That'll do it.
I mean, he would have had to pay an awful lot of money, and he would have had to go to jail for a long time.
Right.
And instead, they deferred. This is all suppressed, by the way. This was all the information I'm telling you. The U.S. government attempted to suppress all of this. They didn't want any of this, of course, to come out.
Which allowed Sater to then conduct legitimate business ventures.
Correct.
Being that he was, I mean, he was born in Russia, but he was raised in America.
Right.
I'm sure he had connections, but was he on the inside track of the Russian mafia, for lack of a better term?
Well, you know, there's a lot more we need to find out. So we don't know exactly, but whatever it was, we have these statements. When they deferred his sentencing for many, many years, and he apparently reported to the FBI on a daily basis, they asked the judge to be lenient toward him and said that he had been extremely important to them and provided them with very useful information, both on terrorism national security, and also on organized crime. And that goes to apparently a claim he made that Mogilevich and the mob were trafficking in nuclear weapons.
Right.
You can imagine how that would get the FBI's attention real quick.
Sure.
And that, you know, I mean, because of what was happening, the Soviet Union melted down and you had all, you know, some of those scientists went to North Korea and so forth. So right. Every reason to be concerned about this. In any case, this guy cuts a deal with them, and he then during the period that he appears to be reporting the FBI on a daily basis, he joins a firm that moves into Trump Tower. And this
Bayrock.
It's called Bayrock. And this firm is a real estate development firm, and this firm goes into business with our now president, Donald Trump. And basically, it seems that a lot of this is even Felix Sater's idea. You probably know the Trump Hotel, the Soho Hotel,
yeah, Trump Soho.
A big, fabulous building. Apparently, a lot of this wasn't even Donald Trump's idea. It was Felix Sater's idea. It was Bayrock's idea. And they raised money from all these people from, the former Soviet Union.
And
huge
in your estimation, is Bayrock essentially just a money laundering operation for ill-gotten, you know, gains that other nefarious enterprises have made in the Soviet Union?
Well, we don't know. We don't want to characterize it, but the thing is you can look at it and you can see the participants. So, for example, there are very interesting figures who put money into it. They're all described in some detail in the article. One of them is a company out of Iceland, which, as you know, its financial system collapsed before the rest of the financial system as part of the Great Recession of 2008. And that FL Group is identified as close to Putin, some very strong Russian connection. So they came in with some money later on. Some came in earlier from people from Kazakhstan and different places with vast sums of money of unknown origin. So that's what basically funded this thing. Now, you have to know Donald Trump was in pretty deep financial trouble. He, against the advice of everybody, made this huge play in Atlantic City. It was a kind of a white elephant. None of this could be supported, and everything began collapsing. And originally, he dealt with banks, and after a while, the banks didn't want anything to do with him. So he was kind of desperate, was looking for money wherever he could. And here come all of these people from the former Soviet Union, many of them, from what we understand, with connections to organized crime.
So do you think, is it fair to say that Trump was potentially being floated financially by some of these figures? Do you think that's what, because you would, in the article,
yeah,
and this is speculation, where as you said, that's potentially one of the reasons he might not want to release his tax returns.
Right. And of course, you know about this so-called tax return with two pages that were
right.
obtained, and they were on Maddow. Those show, I was surprised there was no comment about this. It shows Donald Trump earning $135 million in 2005. Now, we looked that up to see how much that was, because we're so poor that, you know,
right.
$135 right. sounds like a lot to us.
Right.
So we didn't know what that was. And we looked at it, and, you know, almost nobody earns that kind of money. We even found that this guy Mercer, the billionaire, a multi-billionaire who funded Trump, he made less than that in one of his good years. So, I mean, this is
It'd
an
be clear,
enormous amount of money.
Because there's plenty of people who, their net worth might increase that much, but he took that as salary.
That was his income that
year. Right. Because a lot of guys like Bill Gates will his equity will raise, but
this is reported income.
Wow. It's a good year.
This Atlantic City thing had collapsed. He didn't see
right.
it.
Where is it coming?
Where
from?
Where is it coming from?
Right.
And so it's kind of in this period that all this stuff is going on. And I mean, just, you know, I don't want to jump to the punchline here, but one does have to wonder, where does all that money come from? If he's in so much trouble, who's giving him all of this? And we see him, this is the period where he's involved with all of these people from the former Soviet Union.
Interesting. And so that's very, you know, you start connecting the dots, you know.
No, absolutely. Now, is there any indication, like, they wouldn't have just given him the money? Like, what were they mostly BlackRock?
Bayrock. One of the things you have to know about Trump is, although his name is on many of these properties, he liked to kind of tout himself as a guy who gets his hands dirty, you know, a construction guy. I put up buildings. I manage workmen, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Hardly. I mean, he really was and increasingly is in the licensing business. And meeting people and saying, hey, you want to put my name on your building? And so in these cases, he receives fees for the use of his name. And sometimes he receives equity.
Right.
And so that can be quite substantial. And I think what's very interesting is a lot of the Bayrock projects that Felix Sater was traveling around the world promoting, those things didn't make any money. And yet these people seem to live pretty well. So you talk about money laundering. You talk about, I mean, this is all hypothetical, of course. But, you can find ways to raise money from people who think it's a good deal.
Right.
And it goes into Trump's pocket. It goes into their pockets. And the thing is never built or
right.
never produces any so-called profits.
I think an important thing you brought up in the article was the idea that Sater, if he didn't have the protection of the government, keeping this information about him, he never would have been able to enter into these deals as a convicted felon.
Well, that's right. And that's critical because first of all, in his felony conviction for assault, I guess it was, or battery, whatever it was, he attacked this guy with, as you say, with the margarita glass. That already was on his record. And then the conviction in the pump and dump situation, these basically barred him for life from involvement in a lot of these kind of securities and financial types of activities. And so they had to sort of mask his involvement in Bayrock. And there was another guy who was the official, you know, front guy and so on. But it's very clear that he held, I believe it was 63% of Bayrock. And he was really the guy behind it. And, there was Trump dealing with Felix. I mean, we have pictures of him with him. He knew that this guy was the guy. He absolutely
right.
knew
and
that.
And so the government seals the record, allowing him to conduct this business. Is that so that he could kind of stay in the mix and continue to inform on people? Why do they have such an interest in him being able to kind of go out there and continue to earn money? Is it, I would imagine it's so that he could continue to...
Well, it seems logical that it's so that he can function and do the job he's offered to do. And what we see is during these years...
It's just like letting a guy earn, they say, when you turn somebody in the mafia. You let them go out and sell coke or whatever they're doing.
Well, after they prosecuted and convicted and jailed all these other people involved in the pump and dump, there he is, and his docket sort of goes dark. And so they're giving him this whole period where he uses a different name. You know, he spells his name Felix Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R, so that supposedly nobody can connect the two if they do a
word search. And
supposedly
in this period, him and Trump are getting so close that they travel to Moscow together looking for opportunities.
He traveled with actually Donald Jr. and Ivanka.
Ivanka,
he was a
who are now running the country.
I know. Supposedly, Donald asked him, oh, you know, the kids happen to be running around Moscow. Would you just, you know, show them around a little bit?
Right.
You know? So everything's always put in that sort of, you know, benign kind of way. But Donald Jr. gave a speech and he gave, I think, an interview with media where he said, most of our money is coming from Russia.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's funny.
The obvious parallel to this is the FBI's involvement with Whitey Bulger, where they basically allowed him to operate, you know, for years, committing, you know, countless murders because he was giving them information. Now, the question I have is it different in the sense that, like, I believe with Bulger, they kind of had a quid, like, they didn't have him, like, you know, dead to rights and then made a deal. It was kind of a quid pro quo from the beginning or early on. It's unusual, but is it even more unusual that they have a guy who they basically have dead to rights, who they're still allowing this much leeway to commit, you know, additional crimes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I the FBI operates that way. I mean, a big part at whowhatwhy.org, we've published many articles about the FBI and how it operates. Some of our articles, and I think we've talked about that on a prior show, are the relationships that they have with, you know, people who are perceived as possible terrorists, where they talk to them and they say, hey, you know, can you go into the mosque and stir up some stuff and see if people bite? You know, I mean, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing is what that was.
Yeah.
We think that the Boston Marathon bombing had an element of that with the Todeshev, again, coming from the former Soviet republics.
Right.
We see these patterns. And so there's a tremendous this story of Trump and his relationships with these mobsters from the Eastern Bloc and the ties to Putin and everything, and this FBI thing, it's all nests in this much larger unsolved mystery of how the FBI operates, accountability, and whether, and I have to say, I mean, we do need to have an agency like that, and I'm sure there, and I know there are many, many good, honest, hardworking people trying to do the best that they can, and we need to be supportive of them. But the fact is that all of these places need to be held accountable.
Yeah.
And there are people in there who have strategies that are disastrous.
Right.
And they don't want those ever to come out. And of course, the media serves the public interest. We're supposed to be letting the air rush into the room.
And what's interesting is this never would have been known. We have in the article here, if basically you say that, you know, Trump's relationship with Sater would never have been known if a Bayrock employee stumbling upon Sater's cooperation agreement with the FBI, among other sensitive information that had inadvertently been left accessible. That employee sought out attorney Fred Oberlander, who combed through the documents. Over time, Oberlander, who was instructing undergraduates at Yale, began to deconstruct the Byzantine financial structure that was Bayrock, which allegedly hit a range of crimes, including massive scale money laundering from sources in the former Soviet Union. So again, this is a story that almost never would have known.
And just to, you know, clarify, what exactly does that mean that there was a Bayrock employee? What information was sitting, like, quote unquote, sitting around with the? What was that? What happened there?
Well, as we understand it, this fellow had been told certain things about the company, who owned it, how it operated, and he was an officer of the company, and he was out there working on these projects. This was a real guy working on hotels and things like that.
Right.
And I mean, if you suddenly find out that you're in the midst of a thing with a guy who is a he was a, basically a convicted felon,
right.
Involved with, you know, financial scams,
right.
Mob ties.
So the FBI approached that guy, the officer of the company?
No. Sater is the guy who's
right.
the mob guy.
He's the guy that they turned. So the officer of the company, I think, probably just heard on
here,
the street
okay.
that the company, this is, you're working.
No, he found papers.
Okay, so
he found papers.
In Bayrock?
The office, yes.
Okay. Oh, he found FBI papers at Bayrock.
He found some kind of papers
yeah,
in
the
office.
Agreement,
okay.
Right?
And which is insane and, that he would
and
leave
I
it
think
around.
Some other
yeah.
things as
yeah.
well.
Okay.
Who knows the details on that? You
right.
know, people do stupid things.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, he then goes and gets a lawyer, and he says, "You know, I got a problem here. What do I do? Because you see, if you're working with somebody who is a criminal and you don't reveal that, then you're potentially on the hook
right.
for." All of that stuff, and that could be just absolutely devastating.
And even if you didn't know, once you do know, you have to immediately sever ties.
You
got
to do something.
Right.
So he goes to a lawyer to find out what to do, and it is through those lawyers that some of this begins to come out.
Right.
But what I want to emphasize is, and this is very, very important, these lawyers have not been allowed to talk, and in fact, the Department of Justice and the FBI, and I think this is the core of our article currently up at whowhatwhy.org,
yeah.
this is the core
it.
Of the article, is that the FBI not only doesn't want the Sater relationship to come out, they're concerned about this whole larger story. They don't like to talk about how they work. Obviously, this very big operation against the Russian mob, they don't want anything about that said or revealed or who they work with or how they do it.
There's something called a hyper-injunction.
Hyper-injunction, that's right. They went to extraordinary measures and they got a judge basically to gag these lawyers so that they couldn't talk to anybody. They wanted to follow through with what they had found and be able to talk to people. They were basically ordered, we are told, not to communicate any of this to the Congress of the United States.
This is fascinating here. It says, in February 2010, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan instructed Oberlander, now that was the attorney who was pursuing this after this guy had found the documentation, in a secret order not to inform the legislative branch of the United States government what he knew about Felix Sater. That order remains under seal, but a federal judge has unsealed a redacted version, and apparently the appellate court was persuaded that the unusually broad order was justified on the merits, but the lawyers opposing Sater found the imposed remedy extraordinary. And they said this is very interesting. Our being ordered not to tell Congress what we know may be the first and only hyper-injunction in American history. If there are others who have been scared silent by judges who wish to nullify congressional and public oversight, we may never know, and that is frightening. So literally, this is basically saying you cannot inform an entire branch of government what's going on.
Right, and you can see what the problem with that is because entities, parts of the executive branch like the FBI are supposed to be accountable to the other branches, and here you have a second branch, the judiciary,
right.
saying you can't talk to the third branch, the ones that are elected by the people.
Right, and it's, you know, so it diminishes the capacity for oversight and it totally removes it, you know, which is a huge problem. There's another guy here because there are so many Bond villains in the article. There's another guy. So Semyon Mogilyovich, who's the boss of bosses, the brainy Don, gets a judge in Russia to release this other guy. And I forget this other guy's name.
Ivankov.
Yes, Ivankov.
Yeah.
What is his deal?
So he's considered to be this incredibly ruthless
guy. Because he's living in Trump Tower.
Guy. Well, that you stepped to my punchline.
Sorry.
The FBI gets a tip that he's now in the United States. That's a word on the street. This guy, the emissary, has arrived.
Right,
you know, dun,
right.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Where is he? Where is he? And, you know, if it's a movie, it's like the clock is ticking. You know, you got to find the guy. You got to find the guy. And they can't find him. And suddenly, I don't know how it happens, but they discover him. And he's living in Trump Tower.
Right.
So here's Trump again. And then as soon as they find out that he's there, I don't know if he gets a tip off something and he vanishes. They called him a cipher because every time they thought they knew where he was, he wasn't there. But then they get another, I guess, tip or something. And there he is in Atlantic City at a casino.
Trump Taj Mahal.
Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
So Trump, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
There was, later in the article, I forget her name, but I believe there were lawyers for Sater who
yes.
defended Sater who ended up working at the Attorney General's office.
So this is another twist in the story is that Sater is described, when it comes time for him to be sentenced, they go before this judge in this closed proceeding, and they say, Your Honor, and again, we know this from some of these partially unsealed things, they say, this man has been a real tremendously important asset for us, not that word, but he says he's been done a tremendous service, and he's provided incredibly important information, as I said, on national security and also on organized crime. He's been extremely helpful and extremely cooperative and reliable and so forth, and so they're asking for leniency. And it's very interesting who these people are who sort of testify for him, because later on we find that two of the U.S. attorneys, the prosecutors for the Eastern District of Manhattan, this is the office that's running this whole operation against the mob, and I guess maybe it's because that's where Brooklyn is,
right?
And where they were headquartered. They then, these two women who are mentioned in the story, they're working at the Justice Department. Ostensibly, they should be prosecuting these people and Felix Sater. And instead, what they do is they're all asking for leniency for him. And then they leave government. And I kid you not, they join a law firm and they become Felix Sater's lawyers.
Right. And the law firm is Morgan Lewis.
We're going to get to that. Right, so that's those two people.
Is that, I mean, I'm not sure if you're, yeah, you know, legally, if you know, but is that like, is there a legal restriction against that? Against leaving?
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, you know, Tim was talking earlier about the revolving door. I mean, people routinely leave the Justice Department or right, anywhere else. You know, for the first a prosecutor, then they're a defense lawyer because they know how to do it. So it's not that.
No,
it's
for specifically for like you were prosecuting a guy and then
That I don't know. I mean, it certainly looks odd. Right. I'm not,
the optics aren't great.
The optics are not great. I'm not a lawyer, but it's fascinating. We thought it was fascinating, and apparently our readers do too. And so these two women, you know, went to work there. One of them's now back, and she moved up and became number three in the Justice Department.
So she's back at the Justice Department.
Very high level, yeah. Yeah. Well, and she was, and now she's out.
And she was responsible for, I don't know, I'm not ruining the surprise, but taking, what's that, how do you pronounce it, Mogilevich off the most wanted
list. I don't know if you can identify that with a single person, but Mogilevich was a few years ago removed from the FBI's most wanted list, which is extraordinary because supposedly they never removed anybody unless they're dead or some other special circumstances. Certainly he was not out of the picture, had never been cleared. And so we don't know what all of these, you know, sort of chess moves are about. Some decision was obviously made at some high level. And I think those kind of things that we don't know the answer to are why it's so important that investigative reporters keep digging, because these are going to reveal, we hope, like peeling an onion, higher and higher levels of what's going on with the gamesmanship between the U.S. and Russia, Trump, these leaks. You know, what is this all about?
Ray had a great point earlier when he walked in. You know, you look at Felix Sater and he's an asset. Is it possible on some level that Trump is an asset?
Well, you know, we've thought about that. I don't know that he's an asset to the country, but but you know, it the way this thing looks, one gets the sense that we know actually that he has always attempted to maintain a very good relationship with the FBI, and knowing that with the casinos, which was much after Trump Tower. I mean, he knew that the FBI was going into Trump Tower. They had taps in there and everything because there were all these arrests in his building. How did he not know that? So he maintained a relationship with them. Now, how do you do that? I mean, if you maintain a relationship with these people, what do they want? They want information. So he's been able to operate unfettered, and you have to wonder why. You have to wonder why he's never come under, if he has, or whatever, more scrutiny.
Now, Sater is basically an asset for 20-plus years with the FBI. Now, we can't know everything.
I don't know if it's... it's 90... it's a lot of years.
Right.
It's a lot of years.
Now, we're not necessarily going to know everything that, you know, did or didn't happen as far as prosecution, but has there been, to justify what they're doing, has there been any substantial prosecution against the Russian mob in that time?
That is a great question. We know that there has been plenty of prosecution, at least on a piecemeal basis. Unfortunately, there was a fellow back when two of the three authors of this article at whowhatwhy.org, Jonathan Larson and myself, are former staffers of the Village Voice back in its heyday when it did really amazing major investigative reporting. We had a colleague by the name of Robbie Friedman, wrote books under Robert I. Friedman. One was called Red Mafia. Robbie had started looking into these things, looked into them for years, and became the number one target of Semyon Mogilevich, who then supposedly put a $100,000 price on Robbie's head. Robbie did die a couple years later, supposedly of an unrelated rare blood disease. Who knows about that? But the reason I'm mentioning this is Robbie was really kind of came into looking at the Russian mob almost by accident. He was looking at other things, and he became involved in it. And I think he really was the leader in investigating that. And I don't know, sadly, to this day, there really is anybody on that beat or has been for years who really has been following this in a kind of a conclusive dot connecting way.
Yeah. Is there, and this might be too speculative, but is they are more vicious. They are, I mean, they put $100,000 hit on this guy. Is do you think that effectively curtails a decent amount of journalism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a clear sense in journalism of the risks involved in doing any of this kind of work, and we either discuss it or we put it out of our minds and just get to it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, So basically, what's fascinating is you have James Comey, who's a very interesting character. I mean, you know, James Comey's this, whenever he speaks, it's fascinating to kind of watch him. And, you know, one of my favorite parts of the articles is essentially, you know, again, James Comey basically saying, you know, I can't go into those details here. I just can't do it, you know?
Right.
But yet, very open, and you point this out, about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails.
Right.
It seems to a layperson like myself that there was some favoritism towards a certain candidate over another.
Well, now we get to another point, which is, I'm going to go back to, you started talking about Morgan Lewis, this law firm. So
yes,
this is the law firm that these former DOJ prosecutors joined, where they represented Felix Sater's interests before this judge in trying to get leniency for him. One of them went back to DOJ. One of them is still there. What's very interesting is Morgan Lewis has a large and very active practice in Moscow, 40 lawyers. And in fact, they just won some kind of award as like the best, you know,
Russian law firm of the year.
And what's also extremely interesting is when Trump was being scrutinized, and I want to pause here for emphasis, when Trump was being scrutinized about his finances, his taxes, his ethics, if he was president, what was going to happen to all of his businesses, he hired a law firm to supposedly sort this all out and make sure he was clean. What firm did he hire? Morgan Lewis. Extremely
That's great.
Interesting.
That's great. Isn't that I mean, this is...
you gotta
I
love
mean, this is... And you posit that perhaps he did that because... attorney-client privilege.
Well, they represent Felix Sater, so right away, you know, it's their job, I guess, to represent his interest, Felix Sater's interest. So now, if they, you know, it actually seems like a conflict of interest for them. Now that I think about it, see, I love coming on your show because you help me think new thoughts. But it sounds like a conflict. I don't know the law on this, but it sounds like a conflict of interest for them to be representing this Felix Sater, who could potentially implicate Trump, and then being hired by Trump supposedly to assure the public that he's clean.
Right. I mean, it's just fascinating. What do you attribute? Do you buy the idea that, number one, and this is just, and this is, you know, kind of outside perhaps, but I'm sure you've looked at these issues. When you look at something like WikiLeaks, do you say that WikiLeaks has the feeling that it's a Russian operation to some degree? Or is that too far of a jump?
Well, I mean, I think that's too far of a jump.
Okay.
You know, who knows, of course. In this world, we don't really know who any of these people are. And we're at a point where people are speculating. I mean, who does Donald Trump really work for?
Well, because you have Snowden being given asylum in Moscow.
Yes.
And then you have WikiLeaks seemingly... you know, releasing information.
I think, to be fair, we have to keep in mind that Snowden didn't have many options on where to go.
Right.
And certainly his exposing things about the U.S. national security apparatus that would alarm Americans.
Right.
Not just the Russia, but a few of those countries had every reason to say, huh, we better allow these people to continue you know, doing what they're doing. And that doesn't mean that they're In they're working together on this stuff.
Right.
The other thing I think it's important to note is that Julian Assange, Hillary Clinton had called for Julian Assange, as I recall, don't hold me to this, to be brought back to the United States basically in manacles or something.
And she joked about droning them. Can't we just drone them?
Yeah, you know, she was trying to prove how tough she was.
Right.
Which is one of her, you know, things she does.
Things, yeah.
And you know, I mean, obviously this guy, Julian Assange, just like Snowden, thinks that he was providing a public service. And we've already forgotten in the partisan rancor, we've forgotten how popular WikiLeaks was for providing us information. Remember that video of the U.S. helicopters, you know, collateral deliberately murder. Killing these people on the stream. The horrendous stuff that WikiLeaks released, just tons of important stuff. So WikiLeaks provided a real service. I'm not a great fan of Julian Assange. I've met him personally and had some unpleasant dealings. But the fact
I mean, not to go into too much of that, but what about him?
Yeah,
you just
know, she was trying to.
You were just not a fan of him. Sorry, that was our something. The show had begun to.
Unspool.
Yeah, something had happened. This is when the government starts to go, you're getting too close.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, what about him were you just not a fan of?
You know, he's an, what do they call it, imperious gentleman. And I think a lot of the people who worked with him at WikiLeaks itself, a lot of them became fed up. He's a very difficult, self-involved, aggressive person. But on the other hand, and I think this speaks to the importance of the work that they had done, at least, and maybe have done, is that you almost put that aside, because a lot of people who are willing to risk a lot, they may not necessarily be people who want everybody to like them.
Right, of course. So you don't buy that the DNC being hacked is a Russian hacker. And that WikiLeaks, I mean, this is too much of a joke.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that it's not.
Right. But it's hard to know.
It's hard to know. And I mean, I think one of the reasons more and more people are turning to whowhatwhy.org is because we're careful and we're thoughtful and we're not shooting from the hip. So we don't know. We tell you what we
know.
Does
it seem obvious that the FBI, though, did seem to have a preferred candidate when they came out?
Well, okay, so now we get back to the FBI's New York office.
Yes.
And this is very important, because the New York office, very close with Felix Sater. By the way, Felix Sater went on to run some kind of, like, you know, Republican something or others for Trump.
Right.
Or Russian something for Trump. I'm not kidding you. And Felix Sater made a large donation. We didn't even put that in the article. I mean, our editors were like, it's enough already. But I was like, oh, my God, this guy.
This is great.
And there's one more thing we have to talk about, is what was Felix Sater doing in January of this year? We got to get to that. But let me first of all just point out that not only does Morgan Lewis now helping Felix Sater and helping Trump, but this guy, one of the FBI agents who was part, you know, they were running Sater. He left the government and he went to work. They created a private security company with FBI people, and their big client was candidate Donald Trump. So there they are, literally protecting Donald Trump. And as I recall, and again, hold me this, Ewer was visibly identified at rallies, you know, physically coming after people in the crowd, manhandling them. So this guy, and as far as we know, they are, you know, this firm, we believe, is still, you know, Trump took his private security with him to the White House, very controversially, and we think these people, these FBI people, are still in there.
Wait,
protecting Trump.
Like, as president, he brought them in?
Yes.
So they're supplementing the Secret Service?
He has a whole retinue that travels with him that's not Secret Service.
They call them the Red Guard.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. In other words, there are so many extraordinary things going on.
And what's the justification?
On.
I mean, because, like...
Well, I think the justification privately is he's going to go, you know, maybe Kennedy would have been better off with his own security
fair enough.
Detail. I think that's the justification.
This gets back to, and as you know, in my book, Family of Secrets, I go into extensively new information on the Kennedy assassination. Nobody in the establishment wants to hear that, and they start calling you names, but that story, just like this story, there's a lot more to it. And Trump, and you know, I just want to mention this, Trump has people talking to him who do read some of these things. And they say, you know what, the Secret Service, Reagan, et cetera, all these different shootings where they were not successful. And then he sees all these people climbing the fence, and they're like, you know what, I don't know if it's Leslie Nielsen in there, but, you know, you better be careful. So I don't blame him for wanting an additional layer of protection, especially as unpopular as he's become.
Right.
Now, we were speaking about the election from it ago. Now, of course, this is an amazing article, and it hasn't been put together like this before. But was this information out there at all to the extent that the Democrat, that Hillary could have, or her campaign could have brought any of this to task on
Interesting
Trump?
Question.
It's a great question. And remind me, after I answer that, to go into this final thing about what Felix was doing in January.
January. Okay. I'm definitely going to do
so,
that.
So that's a great question. I love it. Hadn't thought too much about that. I will say this. I think that we overrate our betters. We always think that, oh, those people know what they're doing. You know, yeah. The people, oh my God, you know, people used to tell me Hillary has the best help, you know, the top strategist, they've got everything. You know, I'm not going to name names, but people related to me and stuff, you know, it's friends, you know, they're all sending me these polls. It's absolutely certain, right. You know, this guy is the expert on statistics, has, you know, worked all the numbers and so on. And so, you know, people sense that they are on top of everything, and they sense that during the campaign they were monitoring everything and putting it all together. No, they're not. They're, you know, these people have no sleep. You know?
They're
working nonstop for 6-9 months. They're crazed, you know. It's all they could do, get up and stick a toothpick in their eye. So, no, I don't think they saw these patterns.
And do you find it unusual in a similar vein that, like, especially after the convention when Trump got the nomination, the establishment media, you know, without any kind of a, you know, shame, completely turned on Trump, like went to war on him in a very overt way. And I'm not even saying it wasn't justified, or maybe they felt principled to do it, whatever. But, like, do you find it, you know, again, I'm pretty cynical, but do you find it at all unusual that they didn't go this route at all? Yeah, you know, when they were trying to, like, you know, take this guy down for so long.
That the Clinton
people. The establishment media, the New York Times, the Washington Post.
They ran a few articles about Sater, but again, nothing this deep and nothing that hints at the Fed angle. Yeah.
Here's the problem. This is an enormously complicated article. We spent 2 months on it trying to sort this stuff out. And, you know, listen, the media, I mean, I'm not a big media basher. Hey, I'm in the media. And I think most of the people try to do their job. But these are, you know, they're not all like, you know, rocket scientists. And this is very difficult work.
Right.
You know, even if they're good, most of them can't put it together. You can show this stuff to, I'm not kidding you. We have like record traffic at whowhatwhy.org on this story. Where people are like, important people are like Facebook and saying, this is one of the biggest stories in years. This is what the best of investigative journalism. And then we hear people are sending it to other reporters at major news organizations. And they're like, yeah, I don't get, you know, what is that? An outline for what could be an article, you know, these little snarky comments.
Yeah.
So they don't know necessarily how to put this kind of thing together.
Yeah.
It's too complicated. It's too difficult. It requires too much sort of painstaking effort. It's hard. It's really hard. I'm not just, you know, maybe I am patting us on the back, but I'm saying it's hard to do this kind of work.
So is it do you think that when basically, because so many media figures are fed information from government sources, that so much of what they are writing is being dictated, they're dictating essentially for these people in power, and that they're not, you know this article is great because you really take a look at why the FBI wouldn't want this information out there? And do you feel like there are people that wouldn't want to write an article like that because they would lose access?
This is huge, Tim. They need access because they cover beats.
Right.
They have a person covering the FBI, covering the, they call it main justice. They have people covering the CIA and the NSA and so on. Now, the way things come out is because the guy covering CIA gets a tip from somebody who's trying to screw over FBI or something. That's how that stuff works.
Why is the CIA at war with Trump? Do you believe it is because they believe he is some type of you know, danger to the country, or is it because he wants to stop their you know, perpetual war machine that Hillary and Obama kind of were fine with? I mean, which one is it?
I think it's a combination of things. The CIA is not monolithic like anything else. It's full of decent people who and I know of plenty of former CIA people, and they're actually lovely people with a conscience.
Sure.
And you know, there's struggles inside the agency all the time, and but I think that if you were to try to identify sort of fundamentally and whatever dominant factions are in there. And by the way, it's not the CIA director. These are lower levels. This is where people use terms like the shadow state or the whatever you want to call it.
Deep state. Yeah.
This is the notion of, you know, constituencies that exist over long periods of time and that also have relationships and connections to people, of course, outside government.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's banking or it's a military industrial complex, these big corporations with all of their war-making profits and so on. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of different reasons, and I think they're all in play.
Yeah.
And one thing I think we don't think we discussed it here, but it's in the article, the idea that post 9/11, Seder, you know, most likely, you know, was used by, you know, in the idea, you know, you talked about how the Russian mob was like, you know, getting nuclear weapons possibly and Stinger missiles. And that, you know, basically in that climate of, you know, stopping terrorism, it's very likely that he was used as an asset in that scope also.
Right. And it's almost it's almost certain that he told them he had some information and that they, you know, he traveled widely in a period when he was tantamount to being a convicted criminal. He traveled widely, allowed to be leave the United States, and he went to the former Soviet Union on a number of occasions, so on. And presumably he was, because he says he was reporting back on a daily basis, he was reporting back. It gets very, very complicated because you pointed out, why wasn't he taken out by the Russian mob? Why would Putin allow him to move around? And see, this is where it gets incredibly complicated, a little bit like House of Cards.
Yeah.
Because Putin apparently knows all about him, is very concerned. This guy, Ivankov, the deputy to Mogilevich, alleged deputy to him, a few years back, he made a statement. He made a statement to somebody about how Mogilevich and Putin are like joined at the hip, and almost immediately he was killed by a sniper while walking down the street in Moscow.
Right.
So, you know, there are very high stakes here.
Yeah, Russian
diplomats,
they've been getting killed recently.
Right and left.
Right and left.
There's a whole, you know, there's a whole history of counterintel, a double agents, triple agents, quadruple agents. So we don't really know, and you can never say with certainty on any of these things.
Is a quadruple agent working for four countries, or how does that, what is a quadruple? Is it a double agent that's flipped?
It means an extra reversal. So for example, if you're an agent, you're working for a country against another country. If you're a double agent, the country that you're spying on turns you, and you're now pretending to spy on them, but you're really giving them information about your bosses.
Yeah.
Now, that's a double agent. A triple agent is one who pretends to be turned, but is actually still working for the original boss and says, hey, they think they turned me. And a quadruple agent, you can figure out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great.
Now, this is it's ultra speculative, but do you think it, and we can't answer it for any certainty, but do you think it's any possibility that he's basically, you know, like you said, like a double agent for Putin or the Russian government?
Well, so here's where this gets interesting. And now
Felix,
we're talking
Felix.
Yeah, Seder, yeah.
I get to my favorite point about January.
Yes.
So in January 2017, and this was in the news, although it was there like a blip, even though it was a huge thing, a Ukrainian member.
I love how your phone keeps going on. Well, you know what it is? It proves how busy you are and how much this story is blowing up.
This may be.
This is a text from Felix Seder.
Well, no, but this is an important one, and I don't know what to do. But
Colt, do you want to take it?
No. Okay.
We'll be done in 2 minutes.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, because a lot of stuff's going on and people want to talk to us.
Yeah.
So anyway.
January.
January, a member of the Ukrainian parliament who's pro-Moscow, this is important, comes to New York and meets in a New York hotel with a couple of guys, and we understand from accounts from him, although he's changed his story a number of times, he came with a so-called peace agreement, a proposal, I guess, from Putin that could be submitted to the Trump administration of how they might rectify, you know, there's this embargo against Russia, which is hurting them over their incursion into Ukraine. And this was a proposal how Trump could solve this whole thing. So he brings it and he meets with Trump's personal lawyer, a guy named Cohen.
Michael Cohen.
Yeah. And another guy, Felix Sater. Now, what is Felix Sater, who supposedly, you know, years ago, you know, out of the picture or whatever, he's with his buddy, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and there they are meeting with a representative, I guess, of Putin to hear what he wants him to pass to Trump. I mean, this is the climax of a great movie.
Do you have any gut feeling as to whether perhaps Seder has been working for Russia the whole time?
Well, I don't want to speculate about the fact is, here he is to meet with this pro-Putin guy and to help pass this thing along. You see, that's why it's so complicated. That's another reason that whatever the FBI knows, they may not even know themselves. And they may realize that they don't know, and different people in the Bureau may think, oh, we got taken. We got played.
How can people donate to your organization so that you can get more journalism like this? Because Who What Why is a real nonprofit. You're not beholden to anybody, any corporate interests. basically you can do this kind of journalism because you're able to, you're not dependent on advertisers.
We literally do this with donations from listeners and readers. If you folks don't give, we can't report. It's as simple as that. We're very, very pure, and we're very focused and idealistic, and we can do it because of you. You don't ask us to carry water for anybody. You just want to know the truth. So the way to donate to whowhatwhy.org is to go to our website, whowhatwhy.org, click on the donate button, or go to whowhatwhy.org/donate. We love the social media. We're on Facebook, Who What Why. We're on Twitter, at Who What Why. I've got a personal Twitter, at Real Russ Baker, and that's where I can have a little more fun, be a little more snarky.
You have anything else?
Just before you go, quickly, just want to, like, because I think there's so many threads, if you want to just quickly bullet point, like, Trump, what Trump is involved with. Basically, in the 80s, he's basically bankrupt, and it seems that he most likely, in, you know, received an infusion of capital from
Russian
mob.
He works on these high-profile projects with this convicted felon who the FBI is using as an informant.
Right.
Then in 2007, the New York Times comes out and says this guy has a criminal past. He has to step down from Bayrock, and then Felix Sater becomes Trump's personal guy.
But we didn't even talk about that.
Right.
Basically, what happens is he essentially remains in the building, and now he's, I believe it's one floor below the Trump Organization. And according to Sater himself, he is a regular, he goes up and chats, hangs out with the Donald all the time. And he's got an office and an email address at the Trump Organization.
Yeah, the business cards.
Yeah.
You know, it says,
special,
you know,
advisor,
special
to Donald,
advisor
Trump.
To Donald Trump. I mean, hello.
And
you know?
So, and then eventually, you know, he's raising money. They're all raising money. Donald Trump wins the presidency. The FBI is kind of on board with that, it seems.
He's in tight with the President of the United States.
He's in tight with the President of the United States.
And he's still functioning, even though what he supposedly knows about the mob and about Putin. And
you know, and very potentially, who knows? You could be looking at this guy being the whole time a double agent. We don't know.
We have no idea.
Russ Baker, it is always great to have you. WhoWhatWhy.org. Go buy the book, Family of Secrets. When is that new Kennedy book coming out? We want to read it so bad.
Okay. This is sidelining me, but I got to get back to that.
Okay, we're very excited about that. Go buy Family of Secrets if you haven't. Go to WhoWhatWhy.org. It's very easy to donate. We love having Russ here. If you want to see Russ live, he comes. He does speaking engagements. That's all on his website, too. It'll be on his Twitter. And thank you guys for listening. Rate, review us on iTunes and timdillancomedy.com for any live shows and things like that. We love Russ. We love to have him on. Thank you so much for coming in. You're fascinating. Everything you do is great.
So are you guys. Love doing this.
Thank you, buddy. All right. Have a good night.